Whoa!
You are listening to Journeys on Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth.
Oh yes, oh yes. Greetings and welcome to Wolf Spirit Radio, Revolution Radio, Ever Beyond Radio, and loads of other things. This is Journeys with your host and tour guide into the unknown, JP, myself, here broadcasting from the north of Scotland. And very unusually for one of my shows, I actually have a live, physical, present, here in the room, drinking tea, guest, in the name of Mr. Dave Patrick. He's been on before. We've been speaking about various things. Please give us an audio check, because I'm doing this live and there's a lot of things to balance. So without any further ado, let's bring that microphone into the mixture. Welcome, Dave. How are you, my friend?
I'm very well, thanks, Jeremy.
Yes, you need a bit of Viagra on the mic here. Hang on. My hands are greasy. That's great. Yeah, there we go. So, welcome, Dave. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Quite unusual. I don't think I've ever been here at 1 o'clock in the morning GMT. Till 3 a.m. But
yeah.
You know, to be in a show like this, well, what the heck?
Well, Journeys is, you know, they say you come on Journeys twice in your career, once on the way back and once on the way up and one. No, that ruined that joke. He's the worst joker ever. I just have to stick to being spontaneously funny, because, you know, doing old jokes, it doesn't work.
Okay.
So, we've spoken before on several shows. Thing mainly Ever Beyond, made the Sunday show slightly earlier. This is a later show.
This is definitely a later show.
Hello everybody. Say this is there's audience all over the world on Revolution Radio at Freedom Slips.
Well, I'm really, you know, privileged to be speaking to this worldwide audience of vast numbers of thousands, I believe.
Apparently, so they
but,
say.
But it's not numbers that count, it's quality. And
that's,
I'm sure,
right,
there's a lot of quality listeners out there.
Well, I do have some very, very, very good listeners. That they listen to the shows, they send me emails back, they give me feedback. It's they're a high consciousness crew.
Right.
And those are the vocal ones. And, you know, you would say that maybe you'd get like 5% of your audience would be vocal and the rest would just enjoy. And so you can see that it's a growing thing, and people are needing this information more and more. We need to know our history, and we need to know how we got here, what brings us to this point in the journey. So I'd like just for you to give a brief introduction to yourself. How did you get to this place? And then we'll talk about what we'll expand what this place means.
Exactly. That's a really good question. How did I get to this place? I reckon the strongest part of my journey is really taking place over the last 10 years, probably like a lot of people. Completely changed in terms of, you know, what my life was like before. I've probably said this in your show before, but for the benefit of the listeners tonight, the first thing that really kind of triggered me in a kind of real sense was my interest in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Mm-hmm. And completely unexpectedly to me, that led me into spiritualism. And from there, it led me into the White Eagle Lodge, which is a kind of Christian spiritualist organisation based down in Hampshire in England. But they have got bases in Australia and in Texas. And they operate worldwide. The big difference between spiritualism and White Eagle Lodge is that spiritualism is still much more to do with mediumship, whereas White Eagle Lodges do with meditation. Anyway, that interest led me to write and edit my first book on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle for his 150th anniversary. That was in 2009, called The View, From Conan Doyle to Conversations with God. And the Conversations with God bit was a tip to Neil Donald Walsh, who one of the contributors and allowed us to use the name of, obviously, his really well-known book series in the subtitle.
Conversations with God.
Absolutely, yeah. So that was great. So that was the... And that was quite an eclectic book. It just started off with this idea. I mean, I know looking back that I was guided to do it. It wasn't all coming from me, that was for sure. But hopefully I played my part to you know, get the thing
real. And not ignore the guidance of silly voices in your head.
Well, exactly.
Stupid
exactly.
impulses to do bizarre stuff.
So, yeah, that was a great joy to do that. And as it transpired, without going into the whole story, my publisher... is the grandson of Grace and Ivan Cook, who are the founders of the White Eagle Lodge. So all these strands kind of interconnected to create the book. And my publisher's name is Colm Hayward. And that then led to a second book on Sir Francis Bacon. Mm. And I'd like to speak quite a bit about him tonight.
Okay.
And quite interestingly on this one, for me, is that I'd never actually heard of Francis Bacon until February 2010.
Right.
When Colm came to me and said, you know, I had this idea for doing the second book. And I said, yeah, I was up for it as editor. And it was like, what can I write about somebody I never heard of before? But I'll finish the kind of view series, as we now call it, because there's been three books published mm-hmm. so far. And the third book in 2012 was on the Cathars, who were... a Gnostic Christian sect who were based in the southwest of France, predominantly in northern Italy, and they were ruthlessly stamped out in the main by the Catholic Inquisition back in the 12th, 13th centuries. And one of the big moments in that was the siege at Montségur in 1244, when apparently over 200 of the Cathars capitulated and came down the hill and walked into flames quite voluntarily, singing. That's the way the story goes, which is quite incredible. So these three elements, Conan Doyle, Francis Bacon and the Cathars, have all kind of been part of my story. And what's been intriguing for me is how the consciousness aspect, looking at three of them, have all kind of interconnected. And they're all in their different ways providing messages that are real for right now and where we're moving in the very, very short near future, I would suggest. Probably within the next 6 months, I would expect big changes to take place. But there's a caveat there. How often have we seen that some big changes are just around the next corner and something happens to, you know. So I don't want to be too kind of cavalier in any kind of forecasting, because timelines can change. But I think, and I think we'll get into this more as we sort of open out the discussion, I certainly get the impression, certainly from all the sources that I've been following and the conversations that I've had, that we are reaching this kind of convergence point. People, when I say people, I'm not talking about everybody, obviously, but there are a significant number of people who are really waking up quickly to what's really going on in the world and realising that something is just not right. And we've kind of known this for a while. I've probably known it for all my life, and probably you as well, but you can't quite put your finger on it. It's just that sort of sense. And so once you start doing some deep research into it, you start to, you know, connect the dots. And once you start to do that, it all becomes pretty damn obvious, I would suggest.
It gets to the point when you realise that if you've been around the block a bit, if you've put on some events, you know how to corral people in and out, you know how to advertise, you know, basically you're learning how to manipulate people. And if you then scale that up on a grand scale, we see that same process has been applied to us, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In terms of like what the big picture is like.
What in terms of the way the planet's being controlled at the moment?
Yeah, the way it's run like a farm.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't quite like to use that kind of metaphor, but I know. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, as I said, for me, there's been a number of things that have sort of come together, which have really made me go, aha, you know, this is how things really work. And as I say, from the kind of spiritual side, you can obviously pick up a lot of information. And I know somebody we're going to be talking about in a little while is Monty Youkin, and you had Veronica on.
Veronica recently, 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, yeah.
Who is Montague Keane's widow.
That's right. Well, I do know Veronica, and you know, I've not spoken to her for some time, but you know, she's obviously a dear soul, and what she's doing to carry Montague's sort of torch forward is wonderful, you know. But one of the great quotes of Monty's that I love to use is, "Nothing is as it appears," and I think that's very important to remember.
That's very true.
And going back to Francis Bacon, and dare I say, the connection with William Shakespeare, all the world's a stage. Mm-hmm. In other words, so much we know is being staged. It's a facade. A lot of what we're getting in the mainstream media, you know, false flag has now become a standard term,
isn't it?
Well, not in the mainstream media, but certainly in the alternative media. Between people, exactly.
Certainly between people. People are starting to recognise that, hang on a second, oh, there's a word for that, isn't there? I've heard that, false flag.
Yeah.
It's still going to get the thing, but we do know, we're now starting to see the process.
Yes.
The next step, and I hope it's not before too late, is that people see the process of a history that's repeating itself. But we'll talk about that later, because this is part of what you're talking about what's happening on the big scale, because we'll be talking about data points that you're seeing, they're all converging to this moment, or this coming moment.
Yeah, well, hopefully. I mean, I suppose like a lot of people over the last few years, I mean, one thing, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in the glamour of 2012 and the Mayan calendar and everything that was going to happen there. Well, I think, you know, looking back on that, there was a huge shift in the build-up. There was definitely a shift that was going on. It wasn't like overnight, suddenly everybody sort of woke up and it was all wonderful. Mm. It's not been like that. But I think
it was... The opposite, really, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say it was the opposite. I think everything is kind of building, despite outward appearances, certainly what I've picked up in the mainstream media, and I very seldom watch it, and I very seldom buy a newspaper, because I know that so much of it is just propaganda. It's being controlled. It's, you know, it's not really what's going on. You're talking about data points. I mean, what I've learned, and I guess we're all different in this regard, but I'll be quite open about the people who have influenced me mostly in the last, say, 3 or 4 years, and they resonate with me. They don't necessarily resonate with everybody, and people can question their agendas, etc., etc. But I always say, listen to the message and not the messenger. Mm. And that really goes back to Conan Doyle. That was one of his great quotes. That he wasn't important, but, you know, it was like, listen to the message. Mm. This is what he was saying to Grace Cook when he was channeling from the other side. And not a lot of people know that part of the story. He was a spiritualist during his physical lifetime.
Yeah. Expand on that a bit.
Well, okay. Conan Doyle died, I mean, as most people will probably know, he's best known for his writing of the Sherlock Holmes novels, which, of course, has been, you know, huge in the last few years, which has really brought Conan Doyle, you know, into public consciousness, which is great. Not so many people are aware of his spiritualism kind of roots. There's a lot of conventional wisdom about it, which is just absolutely not true. And if I can just say at the moment, Conan Doyle was a skeptic for about 30 years. He'd grown up a Roman Catholic, and he kind of turned his back on the Catholic Church. He realised it wasn't for him. He'd gone to a Jesuit school at Stonywood in Lancashire, and I don't think he was very well treated by the Jesuit priests, surprise, surprise. He became agnostic for a while, and then he started to look at spiritualism back in the 1880s. So he'd been a sceptic about spiritualism for about 30 years. It wasn't some kind of overnight thing. But he eventually came out during the First World War in November 1916 in an article in Light magazine, which is the magazine of the College of Psychic Studies in London. And this was where he declared that, no, he had gone through all the scientific research for the afterlife with people like Sir Oliver Lodge, Sir William Crookes, all the eminent scientists of the day. And for him, it was a case of saying, well, the scientific evidence is all there, and he was going to spend the rest of his life, which turned out to only be about another, you know, 13, 14 years, to go and really tell his story about, or not his story, but to share what he knew about spiritualism, to kind of open it up to a wider world. And he, you know, he spoke to very large audiences, but in the main, they tended to be, well, it tended to be a bit, you know, preaching to the converted, you know, because it was already spiritualists he was talking to. He didn't quite manage to get it out to a wider audience, which is really what he'd hoped. But going back to the Grace Cook connection, which is quite interesting, Conan Doyle died on 7th of July 1930, and, funnily enough, he was actually supposed to meet Grace Cook. It had been arranged through Conan Doyle's daughter and his wife, Lady Jean, but unfortunately he died 2 weeks before they were due to meet. However, they set up a circle, and actually this has gone forward quite a number of months. This is going into, if I can remember the exact dates, it was certainly in the early part of 1931, about a year after he died, and over an 18-month period, this group would meet. Now, just to explain that Grace Cook was one of the best-known spiritualist mediums of that era, you know, in the 1920s and into the 30s and beyond. And so in the sittings, there would be Grace, there would be her husband, Ivan Cook, there would be his sons by his second marriage, that was Dennis and Adrian, and there'd be one or two others, and they weren't always exactly the same group, but they would meet over an 18-month period. And Grace Cook, there's a connection there with the Polaire Brotherhood in France, but I won't go into all that, because that's probably a big enough story in its own right. But there's a connection there, and her spirit guide is White Eagle, and White Eagle was the guide who helped to bring Conan Doyle's message in through Grace Cook. Now, what I hadn't really appreciated at the time was that to make that connection through a spiritualist medium is actually incredibly, incredibly difficult. And what Conan Doyle was able to do was to explain the process from the other side and what was involved. Because there's a lot of rubbish spoken about, you know, mediums are there to, you know, to speak to the dead. Well, no. It's the other way around. They speak through mediums if they so choose. But it's like, what would you call it, a transformer. To make that connection, Grace Cook would have to raise her vibration quite significantly, and almost like Conan Doyle from the other side would have to dampen down, lower his vibration, so it would kind of equate. But even then, it was just it's a bit like tuning.
Somebody reaching up to a low roof. And somebody reaching down to the lower.
Exactly. It takes a lot of energy, both sides, to do that. And that's why they could only get the information through in short bursts.
That old Michelangelo picture, you know, damn, damn, zip,
zip, zip, with the fingers thing. Yeah, that doesn't work in the radio, Jeremy.
No, it doesn't. Really. But then, you know, the Michelangelo, famous God and Adam. Anyway.
But I should just say that the reason I know this information now is that when I was in the Spiritualist Church, I'd been involved for a couple of years, and somebody had said to me, "You've got an interest in Conan Doyle, haven't you?" I said, "Yes," and they put this book in my hand, and it was The Return of Arthur Conan Doyle by Ivan Cook, which I'd never heard of before, and I'd never heard of Ivan Cook.
Now, Ivan Cook?
Well, Ivan Cook is Grace Cook's husband.
Obviously, yeah.
Right. Okay. So the book was about the write-up of this 18 months of channel sessions. Right. So if anybody wants to get the lowdown on Conan Doyle's spiritualism from the other side and the foundations of the White Eagle Lodge, which was actually set up in 1936, mm-hmm. formally, that's the book to get hold of. That changed my life when I came across that.
That has subsequently expanded into a publishing empire and spiritual network all over the world.
You're talking about the White Eagle Lodge? Yeah. Well, they've got their own publishing, the White Eagle Publishing Trust, I think it's called. And they've published a number of books on White Eagle, and you know, books written by Grace Cook. I mean, a real range. I mean, for anybody that's interested in, for example, Earth energy and how places like Stonehenge were constructed, mm-hmm. I would recommend A Light in Britain, because what that is about. Grace and Ivan used to love touring about the country, and used to love going up to Scotland. I mean, they lived down in Hampshire, but they toured about, and what they would do, they'd go to these sacred sites like Avebury or Stonehenge or Callanish or whatever, and Grace would go into a deep trance, and she would visualise not just how these places were constructed, but also how they were used for like ritual purposes or processions or whatever. And of course, you know, what we know now about, you know, Stonehenge and, you know, the Great Pyramid, and it was all done through mind control and levitation. It wasn't done through rollers and pulling, you know, stuff over logs and what have you.
You couldn't do it. The logs would be crushed like mastics.
Of course, you know, and
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah. So, going back to the Conan Doyle, Grace Cook connection, that's what really triggered... certainly the White Eagle Lodge set up, and as I say, that's now worldwide. Now, you could argue that spiritualism... what I was going to say here is that, you know, I've researched Conan Doyle quite a bit, and I've read a lot of the biographies of him as well. Now, the spiritualistic aspect of his life by traditional biographers tends to be either they ignore it altogether, or it's just fair game for having a go at. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I find really, really not very helpful at all.
It's a little offensive, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is, because they haven't really taken the time to go and research it for themselves. You know, it's just like fair game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the Cottingley fairies, you know, imagine believing in fairies and delusional and nonsense and all these sort of words. And what I find really offensive is the fact that they don't declare their own kind of, you know, where they're coming from, because nobody's ever neutral in these kind of situations. Now, people like Owen Dudley Edwards, who's a great Conan Doyle biographer, and he was a contributor also to my book, The View, the book I spoke about.
Yes.
Well, Owen, he's a fellow at Edinburgh University. He's from Ireland originally, a lovely guy. Now, Owen is a Roman Catholic, and he, you know, as far as he's concerned, spiritualism exists, but he's made the choice that he doesn't want to go there, you know, and that's fine. I respect the fact that he's been genuine about that. But there are others who just have a go, and you can kind of speculate, well, I wonder where they're actually coming from, you know.
Whether they're being paid to say stuff like that.
Well, I don't know so much about that, but you know, if you turn the question in its head, we know that Conan Doyle turned his back on Roman Catholicism, and he'd been at the Jesuit school, and you know, so why are they not asking questions about people going into Roman Catholicism and the Jesuits? Why are they not querying about them being gullible? To me, they're far more gullible than anybody who's going in with an open mind into spiritualism or anything connected with that. So we've got, you know, because that's the world that we've been conditioned to think is kind of normal. But of course, the edifice of the Vatican and everything is completely breaking down now.
And we're seeing truly what corruption means.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and what, you know, in a way, corruption is a bit of a euphemism. And we're now seeing what it really does mean, and what the effect it has on the psyche of children who grow up in that environment, and who go on to join in with it. And I'm very happy that that is now being exposed, because if it's exposed, it will stop.
Well, you'd think so, but well.
Or it will go deeper underground.
Anyway, I think we need to focus on the positive side of everything that's going on. We can maybe just go forward to Francis Bacon.
Francis Bacon is a historical character. I mean, do explain who these people are, because
I think so.
Our audience covers all kinds of spans, and not everybody understands British history or...
Well, just to differentiate as well, because Francis Bacon, we're not talking about the recently deceased Francis Bacon, the artist. We're talking about Elizabethan Sir Francis Bacon, who was born in 1561 and purportedly died in 1626. But yeah,
there's a mystery which we will explore later on.
Yes.
So, Francis Bacon.
Well, as I said earlier, when Colin came back to me about the second book on Sir Francis Bacon, I had to openly admit I'd never heard of the name at all. I'll be quite honest here, because in the Scottish education system, we just didn't cover it. Yeah. And I certainly had no idea at the time of any kind of controversy about the Shakespeare authorship question. Yeah. You know, to me, Shakespeare, you know, we just did the Shakespeare plays.
This bald bloke with the king, and he had whatever. The feather and the people and the Avon. And
so anyway, when I started to do a little bit of research on Bacon, because just to explain, well, you've seen the View books, I think you've seen one or two of them, and the way they're constructed. I'm the editor, so I do the introduction, and then have over 20 contributors with a chapter each. But I've got to put a chapter in myself. Mm. I suppose I don't have to, but you kind of feel obliged that you should put something productive in. So, as I said, my immediate question was, oh, blimey, how do I write about somebody I've got no idea about? So I did a little bit of initial research, and two things popped out. One was Bruton Vault in Williamsburg, Virginia, and connected with that was Oak Island in Nova Scotia.
Let's just pronounce these words. Bruton Vault.
Bruton, Bruton, mm-hmm. Vault.
And the other place is called...
Oak Island, O-A-K as in the tree,
Oak Island.
Now, just going on to Oak Island first. Oak Island is reckoned to be the longest treasure hunt in the world, or the longest, you know, that's been going on
for the longest running,
since 1795. Mm. Three boys apparently stumbled across this pit on Oak Island, and there's been digging going on there ever since. They've dug to a depth of, I don't know, over 100 feet anyway. And there's a lot of debate about whether there's artifacts down there to do with Francis Bacon or the Knights Templar or both or whatever. And so there's been a lot going on there. But Bruton Vault in Virginia is supposed to be a place where there are artifacts hidden, which are to do with the original Declaration of Independence in the United States, mm-hmm. possibly the Shakespeare original plays, the complete version of New Atlantis by Francis Bacon, mm-hmm. all sorts of things. So anyway, I'll come back to these things later, but so in terms of the book, Bruton Vault and Oak Island were like two like treasure hunts to me. Mm-hmm. So I'd never heard of either of them, and I thought, well, at the very least, anybody who's reading the book who's never heard of them, I can at least create a story about, well, what's been the history and where are things at now. So, okay. And then the other thing that popped out was, as I say, this book New Atlantis, which was supposedly published posthumously the year after he died. He supposedly died in 1626, and this came out in 1627. Now, the New Atlantis was based on this fictitious island called Bensalem. And it was talking about this very sophisticated society in the future, which was based on not an aristocracy, but more of a kind of meritocracy, where people had positions of status, but not status in terms of greed and power, but in terms of what they could contribute to the community.
Responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. And they were philosophers and scientists and people who could really contribute those skills. And it was intended that this society was developed for the benefit of everybody, not just for the select few. And another interesting part of it is that they didn't need money. Now, it was always thought that from Bacon's point of view, that this book was really laying, or was really mapping out, excuse me, the template for what became the United States of America, the New World. And so when I started to sort of look at this, my immediate question was, well, hold on a minute, if this is supposed to be some kind of utopian society in the United States, how come we seem to have landed in such a mess now? You know, what has gone wrong? So on the one hand, I had Oak Island, Britain Vault, and on the other hand, I had New Atlantis and comparing with the United States. And I kind of intuitively knew there was probably going to be a connection between the two. So that's what kind of kicked off my sort of research for the chapter in the book, which is called The View Beyond. The Conan Doyle book's beyond. Called The View. Oh, yeah, well, exactly. Everything's beyond. And then, of course, the last one was the Cathar View. But going back to View Beyond, if I can follow my train of thought.
You talk about Conan Doyle and his... sorry, I derailed you.
No, I wasn't talking about Conan Doyle. I was talking about Francis Bacon.
About Bacon and about how his...
About his vision about this future world.
Yes.
But what I realised as well, because it was only February 2010 mm-hmm. that Colm asked me about doing this book, and the book had to be finally published for the 22nd of January 2011, because that was the 450th anniversary of Francis Bacon's birth. No pressure, yeah. So I had to write the chapter and obviously coordinate everybody's chapters coming in and editing. But of course, with email and so forth, it's a lot easier. I mean, I find it very, very enjoyable, you know, and of course it's building up networks all the time for me, you know, because new people are coming in and contributing and you're learning. And to use the famous Bacon quotation, knowledge is power, because it really is. Mm-hmm. But of course it's how we use it, that's one of the things we're going to be talking about. Anyway, so going back to Britain Vault, Oak Island and New Atlantis. Now, completely lost the train of thought now. No, right, what it was, right, doing the research, I could only find out so much information through books or the internet, and then I realised I couldn't, one, afford to actually visit those locations, and I didn't have time to do it anyway, and an idea sort of hit me, we could do some remote dowsing. Because I'm a member of the British Society of Dowsers. I wouldn't say I was a great dowser, but I do dows. And I've got a friend, Mark Harris, who's based up in the Black Isle. He's above the Black Isle.
The Black Isle is the Inverness point of Scotland.
That's Wick and Shetland and stuff like that. It's heading that way.
As far as I'm concerned, that's north. it's just beyond Inverness. It's a north of Inverness area.
Anyway, so I contacted Mark just over a coffee, and I said, "Look, Mark, I'm researching for a chapter for this book, and want to do some remote research on Britain Vault and Oak Island. How do you fancy setting up some dowsing sort of exercises or experiments to see where it takes us?" And it was actually quite fascinating, the information that we came up with. I mean, it was very much a kind of snapshot. And the other thing to say is, you know, dowsing is not 100% science, but, you know,
it's not a precise science.
Not precise.
It does have... it has a lot of merit because it transcends limitations of time and space, and actually going out there with a ruler. Can find out how long it is without measuring it with a ruler.
So anyway, we ended up with the chapter in the book, and as I said, the book is called The View Beyond, Sir Francis Bacon, Alchemy, Science, Mystery. And that was published 22nd of January 2011. Mm. And that particular chapter that Mark and I wrote in the book is called Bacon, Buried Treasure and a Burning Desire to Help Humanity. Because I honestly believe that Bacon wanted to help create that future society that was for the benefit of all. And of course, what we've got now is a society that is for the benefit of the few. And it has been deliberately constructed like that. And that's what we're hopefully exposing. And the next question is, well, what do we see beyond that once that's all been, you know, stripped away? So having written that chapter, I was then invited to speak to the Francis Bacon Society in London. Now, that's very interesting. Well, number one, the Francis Bacon Society is it's reckoned to be the oldest still active literary society in England.
It's the oldest fan club. Well, yeah. Apart from Christianity, I suppose.
It was formed in 1886, mm-hmm. which again, coincidentally, was about the time that Sherlock Holmes was being developed by Conan Doyle. But so anyway, I was invited to give this presentation, and I had the same sort of dilemma. Well, you know, I'm not an expert in Francis Bacon, what do mm-hmm. I talk about? All I could really talk about was my story about how I got there. And so I used slides and what have you, and I talked about the synchronicities that happened along the way, because they were quite incredible, you know, looking back. So I stood up in front of, you know, about 30 people and said, look, you know, I'm obviously not a Bacon expert, because I've only found out about the guy a couple of years back. I'm not a Shakespeare expert. I'm not a historian. I'm not an academic. So what am I? Well, I'm just me. All I can do is share my story. And they really enjoyed it. They really liked it, because it gave them something that was a bit different from just, you know, cold academic type research. And I was then invited back to give another talk, and I was then invited to become editor of Baconiana, which is the journal of the society, which is published online. Now, initially, when Peter Welsford, who's the chairman of Bacon Society, asked me about taking on that role, I said, well, hold on a minute, Peter, I couldn't possibly do that, because I don't have the experience, I don't have the expertise in Francis Bacon and what have you. But he was very insistent. But now that I've got the first issue under my belt, we actually published it in March this year.
Right. So is it free online?
Yeah, yeah. So
Where can people find that?
If you go onto the website, it's the Francis Bacon Society. Sorry, not the. It's www.francis, that's IS, baconsociety.co.uk. And if you go on there and then click on Baconiana, and go to the bottom, it's issue 5. And you'll see that came out in March this year, as I say. I think JP's just looking up online as we speak.
I was just typing the address. Francis Bacon, I can spell Bacon, society.co.uk. There we go. And that will go... Francis Bacon, society.co.uk. Okay, there we go. So, I pop that in there, and into the other chat room. We have multiple chat rooms. There we go. So, so people can check out the Francis Bacon Society. They can check out your first effort as magazine editor.
Yes.
And have you preserved the house style? Have you tweaked it a bit here and there?
Well, to be honest, if you read the editorial, I've said right up front that my style is probably going to be quite different from what's gone before.
Of course.
I'm quite happy to put my own sort of mark in it. I've not tried to copy, I've not really looked at what's gone before. I've just gone with what I think fits best. But the reaction to it has been very good. I mean, I was really lucky that the selection of contributors this time around has been very strong, because it was the first issue that's been published for about 3 years. Yeah. So there have been, you know, one or two things sort of stacking up.
So it's not a monthly.
No, I mean, the next one's it's not going to be till the beginning of next year.
All right. So
no, it's quite...
It's quite a relaxed...
Yes. But we had people like Petter Amundsen, who's... Well, he's become a well-known Norwegian researcher into Bacon and Shakespeare, and the ciphers, and he's done a lot of work in Oak Island. I don't think he's done anything in Bruton Vault. People like Richard Dallin Wagner, again, interestingly, have you come across the mystery house in? This is Sarah Winchester's mystery house in California, the one that's all kind of weirdly designed and built. And it's she was the wife.
It sounds like a house a friend of mine was saying she used to live in. Is it by the beach in Laguna Beach? Was it used by pirates for smuggling rum?
No, I don't think so. She built it in the early part of the 20th century.
No, this is older than that.
No.
It had all this house had all these. Tell us about this house.
Well, she was the widow of I forget his Christian name. Is it William Winchester? Anyway, he was the guy that had the Winchester Rifle Company.
All right.
And anyway, he died, and the story was that she went into spiritualism, and then she started getting all these messages from whatever, and she was told to build this house. Of course, you know, a lot of people think she went a bit dilally, a bit crazy, and that this house is just a folly. But what Richard Wagner had said, and people might want to look this up because it's actually available as a free PDF online, and it's a book called The Lost Secret of William Shakespeare, and he actually talks about this house and what he says. And Richard Wagner is I think he's a 33rd degree Mason and Knights Templar, so he really knows his stuff. He says this house is actually how can I put it? It's actually a kind of guidepost to help people elevate themselves into a higher consciousness through almost like fourth dimensional mathematics, if that kind of makes sense.
Keep going. This is very interesting because, I mean, this is partly what the journey is about, is the journey to ascension.
Yes.
And so... there are people who have been doing this for a very long time, this whole ascension process, and they haven't been telling everybody. They've been very secretive about it, probably because people hate them, and probably that they're seen as machinating, you know, manipulators. And but they've had the they've had the monopoly on the ascension business. In fact, them and the church had the monopoly on the ascension business. And I think what we're trying to do is bust that monopoly, and everybody gets an ascension. You get an ascension, you get Oprah on it.
Well, I think we're already, I think we're already moving beyond third dimension into fourth and
our frequency
fifth.
Is ascending.
Of course it is, and you know, and I think we've discussed this before. You know, about I was just reflecting on this the other day when I was. You know, when I was thinking about David Icke, I was going to say earlier that the people who had the most impact on my kind of thinking, and I'll say up front that David Icke is one of them. Mm-hmm. I've always liked him. I've met the guy once. His stuff resonates with me. And what I find interesting is that, you know, people can often say, "Oh yeah, I can take a lot of what David Icke says, but I can't take this reptilian bit with the royal family." And to me, that's one of the more obvious things to take. You know, I've got absolutely no problem with that at all. But from a point of view of ascension, my understanding is that that reptilian vibration operates in the fourth dimension. So if we are really heading towards fifth dimension, we're actually going to be transcending where they're actually stuck at the moment.
Right.
And maybe that's why a lot of it is really now coming to light, which is, you know, amazing. You know,
I think you're pretty spot on there, is that as we're rising, first of all, we rise through the fourth dimension, and they become visible, and then they'll lose their visibility as we ascend beyond that.
I think they'll just be forgotten about.
They'll just be something that was a vague memory, perhaps, and presumably all of this war and trauma will also go like that.
Well, I would certainly hope so.
Yeah, it's a bit like, you know, people who give birth, women who give birth, generally, you know, you don't remember the actual bit of it because, you know, there are body chemicals that stop you from doing so.
Mm.
It's a protection. Yeah.
A bit like past lives.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm.
You get the voltage. Before you come in, that makes you forget. Yeah, so about 15 minutes to the top of the hour. So.
Mm.
You were talking about you were talking with the Bacon Society, and they asked you to edit the magazine.
Yeah, and Peter Welsford had been very interested. He's the chairman of Bacon Society. Very interested in finding out more about Bruton Vault. Now, when I checked previous Baconiana copies, because it used to be obviously in hard copy initially.
Can you spell that word?
Baconiana.
Yeah.
Bacon, as in bacon, Iana.
Ah, it's like Americana. You got Baconiana.
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 Well, that's the name of the journal.
Oh, is it? That's the name of the journal. All right.
And I suppose ephemera to do with bacon would be called Baconiana as well.
Baconism.
So you know, one of the things I checked initially was previous copies of Baconiana to see what there was about Bruton Vault. All I could find was a two-part article in April and July 1951.
All right, so it's due for a rerun.
Yeah, but that was quite an interesting year, because that was the year I was born. I was actually born in February 1951. Give my age away now, but so what? It's a number. But whether that was just coincidence or synchronicity or whatever, that doesn't really matter anyway. So I've actually reprinted that article. It was by a guy called Albert Stewart Otto, O-T-T-O.
Mm-hmm.
So that's reprinted in the current Baconiana in March this year. So anyway, that was the only thing that I could find. And then when I went online, there was actually very little information that you could find. You know, if anybody wants to put Bruton Vault in to a search engine or link it with Francis Bacon, you're not going to find very much.
See what a simple Google search returns. Mm. Okay.
And because I mean, we call this the Bruton Vault mystery because there's not an awful lot known about it. And if you think about it, if there are things that are supposedly secreted away, they're not going to be that easy to find. So you're not going to sort of suddenly come across documents that are going to spell the whole thing out for you.
Yeah.
And that's why things like ciphers are so important and codes. And this whole intrigue about the Shakespeare plays, you know, whether there are actually deeper meanings that are coded in those plays.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure that a lot of the Bacon-type information has been coded and it's been shielded for a future time, and I think that time's now. Why do I say that? Because there's been some quite remarkable synchronicities that have been happening recently. Now, as I said, when I was doing my kind of quotes traditional type research to look at the sort of primary sources. Well, anybody that knows anything about Bruton Vault will know that the main player initially to get involved was Marie Bower, who became Marie Bower Hall when she married Manly Palmer Hall.
Oh, right.
Right. And she instigated a dig in Bruton Churchyard in 1938. And there's a complex story behind Marie, how she got involved in it. It's all written up in this book called Quest for Bruton Vault, which was actually published eventually in 1984. There was a slimmer book published in 1940 or initially, called Foundations Unearthed, and it was talking about how she'd managed to decode from gravestones and what have you the position of where this vault, you know, was. Now, Bruton Church, over the years, has actually it's, you know, the original church is gone, it's been replaced by a different church, and so of course the churches are in different, slightly different locations. So when they did the initial groundworks in 38, something happened and they were covered over quite quickly, and then nothing really happened until 1991, and there was a kind of unofficial dig that was done by a group that was led by a woman called Marsha Middleton, or Amarushka as she's known, and her website is Sun Nation. And when they did that, and then of course it was found quite quickly, and then again that was stopped, and then the Williamsburg Foundation said, okay, just to kind of confirm that, you know, whether there's anything there or not, we will do an official dig. So they did that, I think it was 1992, it's either 91 or 92, and so they did a dig, and lo and behold, they said, no, we haven't found anything. They'd come across some kind of, you know, grave relics, and they didn't want to, the story was they didn't want to disturb them any further. And, but Marie Bauer, she was still alive at this time. She was, now let's think, she was born in 1904, and she died in 2005, just before she was 101. So she'd have been about 90 when, or coming up for 90 when they did this so-called official dig. But she always said that they deliberately dug in the wrong place. So so since 1992, I mean, that's now another 22 years that nothing has really happened. And of course, this is where you can get into the conspiracy theory a lot, because if you look at the sort of background to Williamsburg and what surrounds Bruton Vault and Bruton Church. Now, the Bruton Vestry, which owns Bruton Church, that bit of land in the church was supposed to be, as Marie Bauer called it, non-purchasable. Now, the Rockefeller Restoration...
Yeah, as soon as that name comes...
Yeah, yeah, but let's try and keep an open mind about it for the moment. But They have been involved since the 1920s. Now, the story goes, and it's something I'd need to check out, the minister at Bruton Vault had actually gone to the Rockefeller and looked for money to actually restore the buildings in Colonial Williamsburg, or what's become Colonial Williamsburg. And what's been happening over the years is that the Rockefellers, through the restoration... And initially they said that the restoration had nothing to do with the Rockefeller family or anything. They just sort of lent their name to it, and there's no direct, you know, connection. But so things have kind of rolled forward, and the Rockefeller restoration certainly had been buying up properties in Williamsburg. I think the idea was they would buy out people, and they would basically say, right, we'll pay the money for the property on the condition that you can live there till you die, and then when you pass on, it comes to us. So, of course, over the years, they bought up, I would think, everything. Now, the big question is, what's the situation with Bruton Church? You know. Now, if you read the Otto article, he says that even by 1951, the Rockefeller influence had been such that they'd kind of gained control of the vestry anyway, but, you know, the people who were involved in it. So, of course, you know... So the big question is, is the big question for me, I'm not saying this would be for everybody, again, are there two sides to this? Or is there a third side, which means there's absolutely nothing there? Now, the two sides would be, right, is there something there that is of real consequence to the world that can really change things radically at a consciousness level, which obviously the kind of, you know, the forces of light would want to get out there at the appropriate time when the world is ready? And are there counter forces, perhaps, who... Well, I didn't want to say anything, but yeah. But, you know, I mean, it's, you know... It, is there something they want to find that is going to stop it?
They'd rather that we didn't know about.
Well, exactly. Because if you go back to the control grid, or as is affectionately called, the psychopathic control grid, as certainly Thomas Sheridan calls it, you can see why, and it's about power and status. So. But as I said, what I've found is that even in the last week, I have come across information that is just incredible. And I've actually found it on the internet, and these sources go back to 2009, 2013, and I just wondered why I'd never come across them before. Now, apparently, it wasn't my time to come across them. Yeah. Everything in divine timing.
Yeah. When the student is ready, the teacher appears, kind of thing.
Exactly.
So yeah, we've got about a minute before we go to a break here. So
what we'll do after the break is I'll talk about some of the kind of psychic tools that we're going to be using as part of our research, because we've actually planned this trip for next month.
And we'll talk a little bit more about your connection, your original dowsing. Because you said you were going to do that, but the original remote viewing, they were talking about Bruton Vault.
Yes.
And that you were using the dowsing and remote viewing techniques. Do you do remote viewing, or is it a remote dowsing? You just ask.
Let's cover that in a bit more detail after the break, because there's some very interesting developments that have been going on there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm. There we go. So. There we go. Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, a listener supported station. Please go by the donate button, buy some things. As I say, I recommend the seed pack. I got some squash growing, I got some all sorts of stuff growing, catnip. It's got a good line of catnip and the tomatoes and peppers growing out there, beans. Lots of beans. Oh, what was my favourite bean? There's one. It's a little dwarf bean. It's only a little, like, 6 inches high. And it's got, like half a dozen big, great big beans hanging right down to the ground on it. So they're quite fun, and they're very nice. You can just go more or less eat them straight off the thing. Anyway, so, and fenugreek. Whoever knows how to use that stuff. Anyway, so, yes, buy the seed pack and support the station. At War Spirit Radio, we are now able to take donations again, and thank you very much for any of the support that you've been giving us. We're having a bit of a time. We've got a lot to do, and we're just only able to dig out the information like email lists. So we'll be getting an email list together in the next hour, so I keep saying that, but it's going to happen. And once I get 5 minutes to myself, I'll be able to sort the email list. Anyway, once we've done that, we'll be able to start to resume normal scheduling, and we'll hopefully be bringing some more producers online, and we'll probably have a lot more European content. So do tune in if you're from the British Isles and Europe. Because we'll be including a lot more content earlier in the day, and that should be quite fun. So, tonight, as I was been talking with my guest, with me tonight, here live, in person, in the studio, in the chair, there he is, Dave Patrick. Hi, Dave.
Hi, JP.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? So, it's unusual. It's very late at night here in Scotland.
Well, early in the morning.
It's depends. Yeah. Did you have a nap earlier?
Not really.
Oh, no. I sold you. You are, mate. Long on into the night. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So probably as a scholar in a past life, you'd be sitting in some basement somewhere with a candle and a scribble. You know,
if I may say this, and I don't wish to be kind of arrogant or whatever when I say this, but apparently, and this may be his connections to Bruton Vault and certainly the findings of America, I was apparently Benjamin Franklin in a past life. And I was told this years and years and years ago, and I've actually had it confirmed by at least two different mediums, one just in the last week. So, and yet the ironic thing is, I don't really know too much about
About Benjamin Franklin.
To lightning.
To lightning. Yeah, well.
He's the famous one who had the key and the string and the whole thing. Yeah, so, well, that'd be interesting to see. And have you found that your interests are along a similar line? But you say you haven't researched that much. I mean, have you researched enough to think, yeah, it could be all related?
I haven't really researched that much, to be honest. I know a bit about his life, and you know, the kind of obvious things. You know, the fact he was a writer, he was a diplomat, he was obviously a founding father, etc., etc. And a bit of a womanizer in Paris, I believe, as well.
A bit of a womanizer. Well, they all seem to be a bit of a sometimes they're a lot of a womanizer.
But yeah, going back to what's the connection there? Well, the thing is, Francis Bacon, if he'd set New Atlantis as being the, as it were, the template for the United States, and obviously Benjamin Franklin and people like Thomas Jefferson, well, I know that they were sort of picking up that sort of baton from that philosophy, and they were trying as best they could to run with that. Now, the other thing that I haven't actually mentioned is that there's a Saint-Germain connection to Francis Bacon.
Yes.
Now, a lot of people think that Francis Bacon was just, not just, but he was an incarnation of Saint-Germain, and then Saint-Germain would reincarnate as somebody else. Well, the information that I've got is that Saint-Germain and Francis Bacon were exactly the same person all the way through.
Right.
That he never actually reincarnated. So in other words, going back to the 1626 supposed death, it was faked, and he actually disappeared off the continent. I understand that he went to Holland, first of all, worked on his philosophy and methodology and what have you in a bit of quiet, and then he moved on to Transylvania. But then he was involved in the, you know, with the founding fathers and the set up of America. He was known as the professor. And just at the time where they were signing the, when they wanted to break free, of course, you know, there was a lot of risk involved breaking away from the crown in England, because, you know, they could have been hung as being traitors. But apparently Saint-Germain, or the professor, came in and gave them a very rousing talk about why it was necessary for them to do that. And of course they went ahead and did it, and the rest is history. It just seems a bit ironic that what we now know is that they never really broke away from the crown at all, and or the banking influence, it's kind of followed them.
Because they were infiltrated crown agents in the first place, in the founding fathers' group.
And that seems to be one of the problems throughout history, that you have people who come in to raise consciousness at a certain point, and these kind of counter forces find ways to kind of, you know, have a negative influence on this good thing. But I think in the scheme of things, as we do evolve, then the kind of the line of development is kind of positive. And interestingly, in you know, going back to Conan Doyle, in The Return of Arthur Conan Doyle, he talks about good and evil, and from what he's saying there, from the other side, is that we actually do need both for that development to happen. It's almost like two circles, and they kind of spin off each other, and
it provides traction.
Exactly.
So that's an interesting point there about the necessity of it. But it's only, I mean, it's necessary for a particular stage. Is that right? Or is it necessary on all levels?
I think you'd have to ask God about that one.
I'll have to ask God. I'll have him on the show next week.
Yeah, or her.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, who knows? We're kind of glimpsing into these higher dimensions at the moment. And but from what I gather, I mean, Yeah, I mean, I had the most remarkable information last week. As I said, I had these. Well, maybe I could go back a stage. When it comes to the research that we're going to be doing in Williamsburg, right? I certainly decided early on that we would need to do a bit of kind of psychic investigation that would use these kind of psychic tools alongside other, you know, more...
Yeah, your regular Google Maps and everything, yes.
Yeah, methodologies. Yeah. But if I could just run through the kind of five that I've come up with and the kind of different aspects. Well, the first one, fairly obvious one, is meditation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't meditate a lot, and it is part of the practice of the White Eagle Lodge. Unfortunately, I tend to zonk out when I meditate, unless I keep really, really alert. But certainly, that's something we're gonna definitely try and utilise as a tool, you know, to actually allow that contact to be made. When I say allow, well, let me go through the five, and I'll come back and explain a bit more. The other one is mediumship/channeling. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, like Grace Cook, having somebody who's stepping in the centre there to hopefully make contact with Francis Bacon or some of his group who were involved in putting stuff in Britain Vault or whatever. The other one was mentioned earlier is dowsing, you know, using pendulum mm-hmm. and bell rods. The last two are quite interesting, and the ones I'm probably most excited about. One is, again, we've touched on, is remote viewing. Mm-hmm. And the other one is accessing the Akashic records. Mm-hmm. Now, I know a bit about each without certainly being an expert in either. The Akashic records, of course, well, I'm saying of course, but I came across the Akashic records initially through my study of Edgar Cayce.
Okay, so explain what they are to people. Some people don't know what...
Okay, from my understanding... Every single thought, action, whatever, throughout history by anybody has been kind of like imprinted on the universe. Mm-hmm. There's an imprint there that with the right resources you can actually read mm-hmm. that information. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the question. How do you...
What the resources are.
Now, I was talking about Edgar Cayce. Now, he mm-hmm. was, for American listeners, they're probably more likely to know of Edgar Cayce. He was known as the Sleeping Prophet.
Sleeping Prophet.
And he lived from 1877 to 1945. Mm-hmm. And he literally went into trance state, and he would come up with readings for people, mostly about their health, but then he'd start to give life readings as well. And he would go back to ancient Atlantis and Egypt, etc. And I think there were over 14,000 readings that were given, and they've all been recorded at the, the acronym is ARE, the Association for Research and Enlightenment.
Ah, right, yes.
Now, my colleague my research colleague is a guy called Mark Finnan, who's going to be joining me in Williamsburg. He's a good friend of the Francis Bacon Society. He's presented there. He's written about Oak Island. His book is called Oak Island Secrets. He's from Ireland originally. He's an actor, he's a play director, he's a writer. He's based in Canada now. And why did I mention Mark here?
Because we're talking about psychic research using the five different methods.
Oh, yeah. So, ARE, he's actually a member of Cayce's organisation.
Right.
Now, they're based at Virginia Beach in Virginia, mm-hmm. which is about 62 miles from Williamsburg. So part of our research trip will involve a trip to the ARE, mm-hmm. which I'm really excited about because I've never been there before. And we're hoping to do some kind of experiment to mm-hmm. access the Akashic records of Francis Bacon and Britain Vault and whatever. So that's one side of it. And then on the remote viewing side, now again, I've not done any formal training in remote viewing. I've done some, you know, group kind of practice sessions, sort of locally. And yes, we did do a bit of remote viewing as part of our initial research into Britain Vault and Oak Island.
But it was very kind of, I would hardly class it as remote viewing, to be honest.
Mm.
But this time around, we want to go into it with a, you know, a really clear kind of structure. Now, the two main influences for me in remote viewing have been Joseph McGonagall, who was the number one Stargate remote viewer in the military, in the Stargate project,
mm-hmm.
which ran from the 1970s through to, well, supposedly 1995, and it all, yeah.
Like,
well,
corporate.
It went underground, didn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as corporate, as, yeah. yeah.
And the other one was a guy, Skip Atwater, who worked with Joe in the military,
mm-hmm.
and his book, I mean, for anybody who's interested in finding out more about remote viewing, I really recommend Skip's books. It's called Captain of My Ship, Master of My Soul. And what's really good about it is, apart from the book, there's a CD-ROM, which has got lots of workshop material in it and what have you, absolutely incredible stuff. Now, Skip, along with Joe, when they left the military, they were both involved with the Monroe Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Robert Monroe, and we'll come back and talk a little bit about this because there's a local connection here. Robert Monroe had done a lot of early research into out-of-body experience, as some people, I'm sure, will be aware. When we say Monroe, it's M-O-N-R-O-E.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't know this until relatively recently, that the Monroe Institute is actually based in Virginia.
Wow.
And it's only 144 miles from Williamsburg. So I thought, well, that's doable. So I've actually been in touch with Monroe Institute. Turns out that Joe McGonagall now is an advisor,
mm-hmm.
but his wife is the executive president and director. So I've been in touch with her, Nancy, and so we're arranging a visit to the Monroe Institute. And again, a bit like the Casey Center, if we can do something experimental and experiential, maybe, you know, with some of the remote viewers there, or they can treat it as a practice session or whatever. We'll see what comes about. You know? Mm.
But so, do you want to put a shout out for Virginia listeners
to
hang out?
What, in Williamsburg?
When you go out there next week?
Well, absolutely. As long as they're, well, and it's not next week. Yeah. First of September.
First of September is next month. Yeah. Anybody out there in Revolution Radio Land who's in Virginia, just get in touch with me, JP at wolfspiritradio.com. Just let us JP at wolfspiritradio.com, and I can connect you in with Dave, who's off to Williamsburg in 3 weeks' time or so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, beginning
four of weeks today.
Yeah, 4 weeks today. Yes. So there you go. Yeah. Awesome.
Yes. So so Monroe Institute. Now, it just so happened that I had a copy of Robert Monroe's third book, Ultimate Journey, in my library. I picked it up secondhand somewhere and thought, oh, this looks interesting. So I thought, I should really start reading this because I'm about to pick something up that's going to be useful for the trip.
Mm.
Got halfway through the book, and then the only photograph in the whole book appeared, and it's an octagonal tower. And it's a place called Fowlis Castle Tower.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I read down, it said Fowlis Castle in the Monroe Fields, just north of Inverness. And I thought, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because I live, as you do,
mm-hmm.
within about 20 miles of Inverness.
Mm-hmm.
So I checked out where was Fowlis Castle, and it turns out it's about 20 miles on the other side of Inverness. It's actually up near Alness.
All right.
Yeah. It's the seat of the Clan Monroe. Now, what was interesting is an octagonal tower at the front of this particular part of the building, but it is very like the octagonal tower that's in the front of the Monroe Institute building in Faber, Virginia, which was built in 1989.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Now, there's another level of intrigue here as well, because
mm-hmm.
there's a guy in America, a guy called Cort Lindahl, who's a cartographer by profession, but he's done a lot of work around, you're looking at these different lines that connect different parts of the earth,
mm.
and the fact that these octagonal towers actually sort of set off lines going across in the grids into connecting different, you know, parts.
So they create lines of their own, are you saying? Or are they aligned with lines of their own?
Well, I'm not exactly sure, but there certainly seems to be... They're not there, they're not just designs stuck there willy-nilly. There's some kind of design that's going on that ensures that each of the eight lines, each of the sides, mm-hmm. has a role to play in connecting up with a longer line structure.
All right, so maybe it's a place where Hartmann lines and Curry grids join, you know, sort of diagonal and... Because when you're looking at an octagon, you've got the four cardinals, and then you've got the other eight, and that's the Curry line. So it'd be interesting to douse it for Curry lines and Hartmann lines and see if that's the point where they all meet at the right energies. That's probably quite an interesting
thing. I've been in touch with Cort just to see if he's come across Fowler's Castle Tower in his research. I mean, I'd really recommend, if anybody wants to find out about Cort's work, Cort, C-O-R-T, Lindahl, L-I-N-D-A-H-L. Mm-hmm. He's based in California, and he's got some really good YouTube videos out there, so if anybody wants to find out about that. Anyway, so looking at Fowler's Castle, now in Robert Munro's book, he was saying that in a past life, this is going back to, I think it was something like 1145 A.D., when the original octagonal tower was built, it was actually built by Robert Munro and his father, M-U-N-R-O. Because, as I say, Fowler's Castle is actually the seat of the clan Munro.
Yeah.
Right? So you've got this kind of past life connection with them as well. Now, the story gets even sort of crazier than that, because, again, it so happened that I was meeting a friend last week, Morag Foster. Now, I know I've known Morag for a number of years through my healing work and through dowsing, and Morag's done a bit of training in remote viewing, so we've done some practice sessions. As I say, it just so happened that I'd arranged to meet her. I hadn't seen her for quite some time, so I mentioned to her about Fowler's Castle. Now she's on the right side of Inverness, just beside Dingwall, so she's only probably 10 miles away. So I mentioned it to her and said, "Oh yeah," she said, "I know it really well, because they hold charity lunches there and what have you." So she's been there. She knows the woman who runs the tours there, because normally you've got to get the tours by appointment. So of course she's going to arrange a trip for the two of us to go out and see it before I go to the States.
Excellent.
See what that throws up. Who knows?
Take some photos.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Take lots, even of all. You know, there might be some details there you can say, "Hey, look at this."
Well, yeah. Who knows? Yeah. I mean,
you'll do the right thing.
Well, we've got a kind of plan, but it's flexible enough to allow for unusual things to kind of float in. Yeah, that's the whole nature of it.
That's the idea, isn't it?
Absolutely.
To create the space
for
synchronicity to occur. Because, I mean, this is something I've always said is by leaving unplanned spaces, it's a crack that allows the gods to come in and communicate with you.
Absolutely.
So you're going next month to Virginia, and you've got three places that you're intending to visit.
Well, at least. Certainly Bruton Churchyard itself. We won't be doing any unofficial dig for the vault. I think that'd be a bit obvious.
Yeah. You're going to take your rods?
I'll certainly take my pendulum. Mm-hmm. We'll be taking some video footage and some photographs as well. Just to... Because, looking ahead, I've got to present my findings to the Francis Bacon Society in December, 4th of December in London. There are always quarterly talks there, and that's my kind of link. I always go down for them to London, so I'm on the spot for that. But obviously, they're really looking forward to it. Now, maybe I should come to the kind of the really interesting stuff that just occurred in the last
few days. This is all about the journey, and the question I asked you: what brought you to today? So, let's talk about today. What's happening in
this is Monday, isn't it? This is Monday. I'm talking about just something that happened in the end of last week.
Okay, so right. Thursday, Friday, yeah?
Yeah.
So what happened?
Well, what happened was I had... remember I said I'd come across these references to Bruton Vault that go back to 2009, 2013? Right. Well, the first one, 2009, I stumbled across it and I thought, oh, this looks... And it was all to do with Galactic Round Table, you know, and I thought, take this with a bit of a pinch of salt, because... What I do, you know, in my research is I never dismiss anything because it just sounds too far out. Mm. Because there's always some kind of kernel, normally, of something that will possibly lead you to something else, or give you some kind of insight or whatever. Anyway, I came across this website, and there was a guy there, Mark Huber, whom I hadn't heard of before, but I think ex-naval. Military in the States, and he's talking about Bruton Vault, and he's talking about how important it was, and you know, when the information was going to be released and why it had to be released, etc., etc. But it was all couched in all this kind of like galactic type language, and as you know, it's not something that I tend to.
Yeah, it doesn't give it much credibility to the academic world.
Well, certainly not. Definitely not. But as I said, I thought, okay, well, let's just stick with it. And I thought, I wonder if there's any more information on this. So I kind of stuck with the Galactic Round Table bit, and I think I did a search on that, along with Bruton Vault. And lo and behold, I came up with this web page going back to 2013, 29th of May 2013. And it was, I mean, both of the... these pages, I should say, were obviously it was channeled information from, you know,
Galactic Roundtable.
Yeah, but the second one was specifically channeled by Beth Trutwin. I hope I've got her name pronounced right. Trutwin. Now, as I'm reading this, I thought, okay, this seems to resonate with the previous information I've picked up. But not only that, well, I can be completely open here about my own kind of, you know, say I'm not trying to, I'm just trying to tell my story for whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
yeah, you don't need to, qualify yourself. Yeah.
I mean, I told you about Benjamin Franklin stuff like that. Yeah. Well, several years ago, after the first book was published, I was told purportedly from Sanat Kumara that my mission was to create a living testimony to the truth of the existence of the Masters. Now, at that time, I didn't even... This is back to 2009. Yeah. I didn't even know who Sanat Kumara was.
Oh, right.
Right. I mean, I do now, you know. And so that's kind of stuck with me. Well, what does that actually mean? And maybe what I'm doing just now is part of that process.
I'd say.
Yeah. And, but in this particular thing, and it was the 29th of May 2013, channeled by Beth Trutwin, but it mentioned the Kumaras and Sanat Kumara and Sananda in the text. Mm. And it was talking about Bruton Vault, and it was talking about, and I thought, this seemed to be kind of resonating with me. I was a little bit put off by the title because it was talking about mass arrests, and I thought, oh, here we go again. When are these mass arrests going to take place?
They're happening, you know.
Are they?
Yeah.
And who's actually going to make the arrests?
And people are dying. Have you noticed there's a lot of bankers dying?
Yeah. But where are they being arrested, though?
That's how they get arrested.
Oh, okay. The final arrest.
Yeah. Well, they don't give up easily, basically, and that's why they die, you know. Sometimes they resign. If they resign, then they gave up a little easier than the ones who didn't give up easily, who have found their way out of the window. You know, they jumped down the lift shaft. Yeah.
Anyway, so when I came across this other information, I looked at the two side by side, and I thought, I just felt there's something interesting here. Mm-hmm. So I got in touch with Beth through just email, and we fixed up a Skype conversation for Friday night. And to say that I was blown away by what she was telling me would be an understatement. Because
you had a very long conversation with her.
Hour and a half.
And yes. You've only got half an hour.
Well, no, I'm not going to... Yeah. I mean, but, I can't remember all of it, but...
Something stuck in you.
But it really started to connect a lot of the dots. And... I mean, I know Beth for real. You know, I could tell that straight away. you know, this was something that was very, very important, and very hard to describe, but it's like this trip to Williamsburg at this particular point is not some kind of coincidence, that there is some real tangible, yeah, there is stuff. I mean, according to Bess, yeah, there is information there. But of course, the obvious question is, well, is it still in the same place? But of course, no, it's not. Yeah. It's been moved.
And it's the Rockefeller Museum.
No, it's not. It's no, they would like to have it, but it's been moved, it's safe, and it's been protected. Mm-hmm. That's probably about as much as I need to say on that for the moment. But also about as I said, Beth said I was. Yeah, I was quite happy to talk about this quite openly. Something she spoke about, and I'd known about this, but I was never sure if this is real or not. And you've probably heard of this, the Nisara laws. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd kind of heard of that in the past, and about the fact that Saint-Germain was going to come in with trillions of, you know, whatever, and it was going to boost the... And I'd always sort of been very, very sceptical about it. But... from what I can gather, it seems to be, it's on the money. That's, you know, that's the impression I got. Now, I'm going by what information I was given, so I'm sharing that. Now, like anything else, I could be wrong, but there was a very strong resonance with that information when it came through. It looks like something very, very important is going to happen, and it's going to involve Bruton Vault, and it's going to happen in the early part of next year, probably end of January, February time. So we're talking about a very, very short window. Mm-hmm. Now, like anything else, there's always the caveat, well, yes, timelines can change, etc. But I'm just giving people a bit of information. They can use it as they will, think about it. But I think this bit of information, alongside other bits that I've picked up, seems to be looking towards this very real convergence.
Okay, let's talk about the convergence. In your research, you're seeing that it's happening. There are what Wilcott calls data points.
Yeah.
Hit us with these data points that bring you to conclusively... JP, I want to come on your radio because I've got stuff to tell you, right?
Right.
You know, there's got to be enough substance in that for you to be able to have the confidence to say that. So, hit me with some data points.
Well, you mentioned David Wilcock. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's been one of the big influences on me as well. He is definitely one of my trusted sources, I would say. Funnily enough, the reason I got into David Wilcott in the first place was because of his apparent connection with Edgar Casey, because there was a story initially that maybe he was reincarnated, and I don't think that's really relevant. I think the guy stands on his own merit. Mm-hmm. I think the research that he does has been tremendous. I think what he's done in financial tyranny was mind-blowing, and as I say, the depth of research he went into for that was
extraordinary. If only everybody read that e-book, that would be...
Oh, well, I mean, you know, there's so much information he's posted online that is really worth reading. Yeah. But people have got... Yeah, it's up to people to make the choice to do the research.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't like the person. And often, you know, we have to ignore the messenger because
exactly.
Everybody's got a personality, everybody's got stuff.
Well, I don't think Francis Bacon was a very nice person from what I can gather, and, you know, in his... sort of day-to-day personality, I don't know, but you're right. I mean, this is back to what Conan Doyle said: listen to the message, not the messenger. It's the message that's important. So you've got Wilcock, as I said, you've got David Icke. Now there's an awful lot of information that's been coming out exposing the archons, the psychopaths, the sociopaths. Now again, some of the dots that were connected for me was 2012 through Thomas Sheridan, mm-hmm. whom I met at a conference down in Dunstable. I'd actually gone there to meet Brian Gerrish and Ian R. Crane, two guys that I'd spoken to before on the phone but never actually met. And they were really good, but it was Thomas Sheridan. He was a graphic designer, or had been in the past.
We've had Thomas on the show.
Oh, you have, right? Okay.
Oh yeah, we've done some good work together, Thomas and I.
Right, I'd love to. Why don't we do a three-way at some point?
That'd be great. Okay. On a Sunday afternoon, because we're all in the UK, you know. And I'm a night bird, and Thomas is a semi-night bird, that'd be good. It would be good fun. Yeah.
It would. But anyway, when
there was an Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotsman.
I was born in Wales, actually.
Oh yeah. All right. Well, I was born in London. I live in Scotland. You were born in Wales. I live in Scotland. Mm. And he was born in Ireland and lives in Ireland.
And you still live in New York. Yeah.
Anyway,
so he'd done a lot of work about psychopaths. Now, that was in June 2012. That was at his conference, and he was talking about 4%, 3 to 4% of the population were clinical psychopaths, right? And then he was talking about proto-psychopaths, and he was also talking about the useful idiots who made the system work, very much a Leninist term. And then, of course, you've got the good guys, who I think are the vast majority, who, because they're not... they're not, like, collectivised. I don't mean that in a negative term, but, they're not brought together under any sort of banner. They're kind of individuals. So you get the few kind of controlling the many, because they're the ones who...
The bad guys have organised themselves.
They're playing the game, you know. Yeah. And they're bound to win the game if the others don't even know the game's been played. That's the thing.
Right, that's right.
Anyway, when Thomas was talking, and he's talking about these levels, about the real psychopaths and proto-psychopaths. Proto-psychopaths are the ones who are not actually psychopathic, but they will model their behaviour on psychopaths because they see it as a way of getting ahead and being successful.
Uh-huh.
Right? And then the useful idiots are the ones who will just keep their head down, just take their paycheck at the end of the month, won't rock the boat, etc. And very quickly I could see, well, the nature of the kind of hierarchy of society is completely the wrong way around. Mm. And the big challenge is, how do we flip it over? And certainly when you look at the banking system and what have you, things are not going to change by incremental steps. It's going to take a radical, complete change in what's going on.
It's an interesting thing, because 20 years ago we knew that there was something.
Yeah.
And 15 years ago we got The Matrix.
Yes.
You hear it. There is a splinter in your mind, and all this stuff, and there is something, it's obviously not kind of our heads jacked into some big machine. But there is something going on.
Mm.
We have discovered over the years, and what was amazing is that 9/11 was the thing that actually started it for many, many people who've started to find out the truth, because 9/11 was such a badly done job. And I think sometimes that they actually did it badly so that we would wake up.
Mm-hmm.
So we find ourselves discovering all of these things about the world that we're in. And so, first of all, we discovered, we know that there's something wrong. We know that there's something wrong with the Catholics. There's something wrong with the government. And people talk about corruption and all that stuff. And now we find out. Now it's all coming out. Now it's coming out. This is all about child abuse. It's all about satanic abuse. It's all about ritualism. It's all this stuff. And because it's coming out, it's able to be purged. And so it's good that all this stuff is coming out. Yet at the same time, they're bombarding us with fear porn. News is not news; it's just a way of making everybody scared.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I did just recently—I don't know if you saw it—but I just had an idea to put something on Facebook, and it was like 10 things I know now that I didn't know 10 years ago.
Oh, great one! Yeah,
yeah. If I can sort of remember them, but. It was
I'll see if I can bring it up, and then we can so I can read them out and remind them.
How are you going to find it? On my Facebook page?
Yeah.
Okay.
So just keep going, and I'll just find your page.
Well, let's think. Well, the fact that Bankster has come into the lexicon,
excellent.
I think that says a lot. I mean, we now know that the global banking system is run basically just as a criminal mafia, and the governments are in the pockets of the banksters. Now, that's, well, I certainly wasn't aware of that 10 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah. And we also used to think that there was a thing called government.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's now we're realising it's all a bunch of names and corporations.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, every government, certainly in the West, and all your public sector bodies, they're all registered as corporations.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so that you got it, have you?
I got it. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to start reading them out?
I'll read them out for you.
Go on then.
10 things didn't know 10 years ago, but now. Number one, nothing is as it seems, Montague Keane, as he said. Number two, corporations, legal entities in their own right, yes, as we were just saying, are designed to be psychopathic in their behaviour.
Yep.
The Corporation Book and Movie, yep. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, as I said, that was another big thing for me when the Corporation movie came out. Mm. Really, I'm just explaining to people if they haven't seen it, and there's a book that's come out as well. It's Canadian producers of the movie. I think it's Joel Bakken, Canadian, who wrote the book. Mm-hmm. But what they did there basically was to do a psychological profile of corporations as if they were individual people.
Ah, right. Good.
And what conclusion they came up with was that without exception, every corporation would have been classified as a psychopath. So when you look at that side of the equation, and then you look at the other side of the equation, that 4% of psychopaths in society, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to marry the two together and realise that a lot of psychopaths are going to get to high positions in corporations and in government.
Yes.
And that's exactly what we've got.
Yes.
Right?
Because the idea of a corporation is a psychopathic idea.
Absolutely.
The idea that a person has no soul, is a dead being, just a future corpse.
Yes.
So,
next.
as a corollary to that, number three, all governments and public sector bodies in the UK and the West are registered as corporations, as we were talking about before.
Yeah.
And again, about 4% of society are clinical psychopaths. Yeah, over 10% of people in senior positions in corporations and government have these attributes. So we are currently controlled by a psychopathic control grid.
Well, that's a term that certainly Thomas Sheridan uses quite a lot. But I think it's pretty obvious when you look around it.
Fair enough. That's that's another word for the matrix.
Yes.
Okay, number five. No disease, in quotes, is incurable.
Correct.
Yes. Number six. Bankster has come into the lexicon because the global financial system is being run by a criminal mafia in collusion with governments and corporations.
Well, we've covered that already.
Yeah, we've been there. Number seven, this is a good one. Our autoimmune systems have been under attack through such things as aspartame in diet drinks, GM foods, fluoride in the water, vaccinations and chemtrails, etc. Yes. We are under attack on every pore in our body, every hole, they're trying to stick something into it. And especially when you're trying to travel in the TAC and the blue gloves. Anyway, number eight. The BBC and other mainstream media outlets are nothing more than propaganda machines. Enough said. Really? Yeah,
no further comment.
Why bother paying for it? Yeah.
Exactly.
Number nine, paedophilia is just not limited to the BBC and celebs. It has been going on and covered up at the highest levels of government and the establishment. Exactly. This is what we were saying before. Mm. It's a euphemism. Corruption is a euphemism for paedophilia.
Yes.
And the establishment is abuse of children from from all levels. And number 10, we don't have to put up with this. We create our consensus reality through our consciousness. Love and truth are the highest levels of vibration. Raise your vibration and help change the world for the better. Heart.
Yes.
So there you go, Dave's 10 insights.
The top 10.
The 10th insight. Yeah. We don't have to put up with this. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Well,
Absolutely.
Well, I think that's the stage we're at now. You know, there's so much information out there. I mean, if people are not, you know, if they're not awake, then there's something far wrong.
They will be soon.
Well,
because we're talking about the financial reset. You see, there's this thing about the Nisara thing.
Yeah, I know.
There's the financial thing, and then there's the mass arresting, and we've been waiting for it for years. Yes. Tell me all about it. You know, I saw 2010, I was there. Oh, yeah, Nisara, that looks interesting. Oh, the cards are coming next week. Oh, they blocked us. Oh, yes. Poofness reports. Oh, this, oh, that. Oh, they've died. Oh, there's the FBI I've got at the airport. The deliveries were going to happen today. They're happening tomorrow, after the weekend, and so on, and so on, and so on. It's been years, years and years and years. So,
I think going back to what I said earlier about Bacon and Bensalem and New Atlantis, and even going back to Atlantis of old, I don't believe they use money either.
No.
So I think the big question is, why do we even need money?
We don't.
Because if we don't use money, we don't need banks.
Oh.
We haven't got these control mechanisms. One of the things I've been looking at, are we allowed to talk politics in the show?
Yeah, talk whatever you like. This is Revolution Radio.
There's two. I mean, to me, the mainstream political parties are a complete waste of time because they're all compromised.
Everyone.
Certainly in the UK, certainly in the US.
They're all politicians. Yeah.
But there's two political parties that have been set up in the UK, which I think are very interesting and worth a look. One is Michael Tellinger's Ubuntu Contributionism Party, which was set up in South Africa. And I don't know if you looked at his work at all.
I have. We've had him on Wall Spirit Radio many years ago.
All right.
And he's certainly been on other shows on Revolution Radio as well. He's a lovely bloke. Lovely bloke.
It was a bit disappointing, the performance in the South African elections. But, I mean, that was the first time. You know, he's planted a seed in there, and I think, you know, I've certainly looked through the Ubuntu information, and it all makes sense. The other one is the Free Energy Party, which
is there a Free Energy
Party? Yes, there is, and it was set up by Dave Parker in the States, and they've now set one up in the UK. I think it was February this year it was formally launched. Now there's three planks to the Free Energy Party. One is free energy, obviously. Another one is a cure for all disease, and the other one is organic permaculture. And they reckon that if you focus on those three, everything else will pretty much take care
of
itself.
That's it.
So I think
you need to deal with food, you need to deal with supply.
So I think, you know, that's a promising sign that, you know, people are starting to, you know, try out new things and break away from the old system, which is...
In fact, the Free Energy Party doesn't actually need to stand for Parliament at all. All it needs to do is send out instructions to every single family in Britain how to make free energy machines, and there'll be enough engineers to receive that information and run with it.
Well, they have been doing that.
I've been talking. I talk with Eva Moore about hydroxy generators. Her husband, Bill Brockbrader, He's a genius. He's coming out of prison soon. They framed him and put him in. Anyway, long story. But he's a real advocate of using hydroxy generators to generate more electricity. It's a cascade effect. It just keeps going on. So I'm all for free energy. Well, I have my own free energy device that I invented myself.
Okay.
I'll talk to you another time about
it. Well, I found it quite interesting because, I mean, my mainstream career was in the oil and gas industry, on the finance side. Mm-hmm. But I now know, having studied people like Nikola Tesla and, Dale Pond, who, I don't know if you come across Dale at all. Sympathetic Vibratory Physics.
Right.
He'd be a good guy to get on your show. But he's picked up on the work of a guy, John Keeley.
Oh, yeah, Keeley now.
And also Rudolf Steiner, Edgar Casey, and Nikola Tesla. So, yeah, when you start to look at, you know, these guys, you realise that, you know, free energy is something we should have had decades ago. In fact, I'm convinced, from what I know, that we've never really needed to use fossil fuels at all. You know, but there's such a vested interest behind this whole thing, and, you know, and that's part of what needs to break. I think a lot of it's going to crumble of its own accord. I think it's just a question of people just chipping away. I think that's part of the raising of the consciousness. You know, maybe don't need to necessarily do a lot, but just I don't really like using that. Yeah, become a new cliche.
It's
about
holding the vibration,
about being rather than doing, and all that sort of stuff.
But it's holding a vibration. It's holding a consciousness. It's
holding
the, basically, it's holding number 10. Idea number 10 is, it doesn't have to be like this.
Yeah,
we want something different.
Yeah,
and if we can hold that, that is a creative space that, in, it's a vacuum. It's, it creates a vacuum. It's, well, we don't want it like this. We want something better.
Absolutely. Well, one of our friends in the in sort of global political sort of arenas, I think I've mentioned this before, Birgitta Jónsdóttir,
from Iceland.
Iceland, yeah. She set up the Movement Party, and for her second term, they folded the Movement Party because that was only going to be there for one. For one term,
wow!
Just to be activists, but she decided they were going to
amazing.
She needed to sort of stay on for a second term to do some specific work. So they formed the Pirate Party in Iceland. She's the leader of the Pirate Party there.
This one's for you, Tracy.
Now, why did I bring up Birgitta?
Because she's connected with free energy.
No,
we're talking about different parties. We're talking about Ubuntu.
No, I think we moved on from that. Oh, gosh.
And then, then you started talking about Birgitta, and we were talking about Keeley, and, God, you've come up with so many names in that day. My mind is absolutely scrambled.
Oh, no, I'll tell you what it was. It was about this future vision. What it was.
Okay, cool.
Birgitta said... And what I would say, and I'll give a plug for my second book, if I may. This is the Bacon book.
Actually, this is the point. We've got like five minutes go.
Right.
Plug yourself stupid, Dave.
Okay, well, the Bacon book is called The View Beyond. Mm-hmm. Birgitta has actually written a chapter in there.
Right.
Now, people could argue, you know, what she got to do with Francis Bacon. But what my postulate was, if that's the right word, was that if the United States wasn't the new Atlantis... Maybe Iceland was, or could be. Anyway, I've got to know Birgitta really well. I had her across in Scotland for a conference, actually at the Murray Arts Centre back in 2010, and we've kind of kept in touch and met up from time to time. But she was saying about this future vision. It's like, as you say, creating that space for, you know, what is it? What is the world that we do want, and focus our consciousness on that. And then, if you know, the more people that can do that, the more that everything else will just dissolve away.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, because, you know, obviously, if you focus on what you don't want, guess what? That's going to be a drain of energy. Exactly.
So,
exactly.
Websites.
Websites.
You've got your Facebook page.
I've got my Facebook page,
and that is let's just check. Is it? It's dave.patrick.56.
Okay. I'm not sure where the 56 came from, but never mind.
That's what your number is, Dave.56.
I've got one or two pages that I don't really kind of keep too much up to date, but I do occasionally. One's The Vital Message, one's The Highland Healer. Got some health stuff.
So are they Dave.uk's?
No, they're on Facebook.
On Facebook.
Pages on Facebook.
All right, right. So,
but in the longer term, this is still a work in progress, but I've got thevitalmessage.co.uk, and I've got The Vital Message as my WordPress ID, and that's going to be my kind of blog, but I've not quite got around to getting it all set up, apart from having the domain name set up.
All right, is it pointing to the blog?
Yeah, there's nothing there at the moment.
All right,
yeah. Okay. So, but it really is watch this space. So, yeah, no real kind of websites at the moment. I mean, if people want to get in touch, I mean, one route would be to go to the Francis Bacon Society website and email me through, you know, the editor. at
editor at the Francis. Well, editor at Francis Bacon Society.
No, I don't think it is that. Yeah. Go to the website.
Go to the website
and you'll find it.
Right.
I think it's actually submissions at whatever.
Right.
Because it's really asking for submissions.
Form?
No.
Nothing so sophisticated.
No, nothing.
Francis Bacon was, of course, using candles and feathers to write his book. So, well, I don't know how far along the way they are with their technology. So, that's it, Dave Patrick. Thank you very much.
That's it. Is it?
That's
gosh.
It.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This has been Journeys. Join me on Sunday on Wolf Spirit Radio, and next Monday. Same time, same place. Good night, brothers and sisters, sisters and brothers, and other genderless beings.